It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A multi-year project at the Chazen Museum of Art in Madison confronts a problematic sculpture in its collection depicting Abraham Lincoln standing over a crouching freed slave. A reimagined sculpture incorporates abolitionist Frederick Douglass, and that's one aspect of an exhibition sparking new conversations about contentious monuments and racial injustice and how museums proceed with challenging works. Call in with questions and comments throughout 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sanford Biggers is a New York visual artist. His exhibition, Remancipation, is on display at the Chazen. Sanford, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you.
Good morning. Yes. So how do you hope people feel after experiencing your exhibit?
I think I like them to feel curious and informed, or, you know, informed with new information at least, and inspired.
I would like to add the word dialogue. I think that has been coming up again and again when you talk about what has happened in this exhibition, that it is really causing people to talk. And what is it that they are bringing up?
I think the conversation is really, I mean, I think there are a lot of things that come up. It's a lot of history that people seem to have missed because it wasn't necessarily covered in school. Sort of like the motivations behind the freeing of the slaves and how that was more than likely more of a byproduct than trying to protect the Union than actually the focal purpose of that of the Emancipation Proclamation. And that the sculpture itself of the Emancipation Group has so many different symbols and iterations and instances throughout the U.S., and each one is a bit different. Each one, you know, comes from a different time, sometimes different scale, different materials, and how that work evolves over time, but in public, basically, and how even today we're still contending with that object. And some states have removed there, some are considering it. And, you know, in Wisconsin, we had an opportunity to do something actually very different and charge the university itself with doing what universities do, open up dialogue so that people could discuss and think and contemplate this work and what it means, what it meant then and what it means now.
The exhibit reimagines Thomas Ball's 1873 sculpture, Emancipation Group, which you say, you know, you see forms of this. One was removed in a Boston park, other remains at Lincoln Park in D.C., and you created a response to the sculpture. Why did you do that?
Well, you know, I think the language is important, and I didn't really consider it a response per se. In fact, I would consider the exhibition itself more of a proposition, a proposal that came out of a lot of the fervor that was happening around other contentious objects. So rather than look at my contribution of the marble sculpture Lifting the Veil as a direct response, I would like to consider it as part of the whole investigation of not only that object, but other objects from time periods close to it. And in the exhibition itself, you even see a didactic timeline and examples of the work compared and contrasted with other works from different parts of the world and that time period.
There is, as you mentioned, the sculpture, and there is such process that goes into this exhibit. It was seemed to be such an organic process of arriving at what this was going to be to respond, and I use that word again reluctantly, but to really talk more deeply about this holding within the Chazen. Why do you think it had to be like this organic process to arrive at this exhibition?
Well, I think you hit on a very good, you know, salient point there. And as an artist, I would say the process of creating this exhibition really was the most exciting part of it. I mean, the research, too, obviously very exciting and unearthed a lot of things. But this really sort of pushed myself, my teammates from Mass Consortium and Amy Gilman and the Chazen itself to really look at how our practices are in a time when we are in a position to provide information, when people are looking for answers or looking for solutions or ideas in how to deal with our own history. And I commend the museum for its flexibility and being so nimble, because they did a lot of things that aren't typical of index school museums. And they opened their doors and they opened their coffers for us to look and study and research. And it was, as you mentioned, very organic how this process worked. We had several ideas in the beginning that morphed into larger ones. We started to invite more participants from outside of the university community to contribute to this event. So it became very large, and it expanded all of our communities, I'd say.
I'm going to reintroduce you here for a moment. Sanford Biggers, New York-based visual artist and the lead of the Re-Emancipation exhibit, as we look at an exhibit at the Chazen Museum of Art in Madison. You can join in with your questions, your comments and thoughts on monuments, sculptures, and where we go from here with museum collections. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. The Emancipation Group statue has been in the museum's holdings for nearly a half century. Why reimagine problematic or challenging art rather than merely removing these pieces from public view, taking them down?
Well, I think the danger in doing something like that is basically erasure. And we're living in a time right now where we're looking at erasure being weaponized, as it usually is. Once you start to erase history, you are more apt to repeat it because you have no precedent. And, that works for some people because they'd like to forget the history because there's some painful, shameful things that have happened. But I think it's actually more poignant and more beneficial for us as a society if we learn from history. It seems like sort of the point, right? And once again, working within the university context, everything that is studied there is being studied because it is precedent. And during the reckoning of the last few years, when the monuments were being taken down and vandalized, it really struck me that we were at a dangerous point because the opposition to those acts was literally to hide it, tuck it under the rug. And that was sort of the beginning. Those were some of the beginning conversations we had with the museum, because the inclination was like, well, let's just put it away until later and try to figure it out. But I was like, this is actually a really good point, because the nation isn't speaking. We're not having a dialogue. And this is really just a catalyst for us to dig deeper into the history we've had and the future that we want.
Can you take us more deeply into the history of the kneeling, formerly enslaved person in the Emancipation Group sculpture modeled after Archer Alexander? Just, describe for us a little bit about their journey and eventually being the subject of a biography.
Well, I think it's also important as we go into that to mention that the Emancipation Group sculpture was actually funded by former slaves in the first place. So this was, money that was collected amongst a bunch of former slaves to say, we want to commemorate Lincoln because of, this emancipation. And they went through several different iterations and even a few different models. And finally, Archer is the one that ends up being portrayed. And there was various controversy and questions throughout that entire process. And I think that's why in this exhibition, we thought of various ways of, bringing Archer to the same stature as Lincoln, because there are some literally disproportionate qualitative values of the kneeling Archer and Lincoln in terms of size and scale, but obviously in terms of stature as well. So, the obvious go-to would be to have him merely stand and be equal to Lincoln, at least in terms of height and posture. But beyond that, he is not clothed. He's barefoot. He has a shackle on one of his ankles. And and this was one of the early complaints of one of the early versions of the piece, was that his face seemed almost vacuous and not showing intellect or even much consciousness, to be honest with you. And I'm sure you're going to get to this at some point, but when we talk about the Lifting the Veil piece, but
yes.
Part of our charge with the exhibition itself was to really look at the kneeling slave as an archetype, as mm-hmm. a trope. And within that, all the hand gestures between Lincoln and Archer, not only that, the symbols of, you know, the proclamation, the scroll, the lynching stump, the bleeding heart that's located behind the podium, you know, and every version of the Emancipation Group has either added different symbols or removed certain symbols. So just the Emancipation sculpture in all of its iterations is enough to make an exhibition about. But we took it upon ourselves to try to contextualize that with other things that were happening globally and things that were happening nationally at that time to give a much larger context. And when we found the object within the Chazen, it was in a gallery that was surrounded by, you know, sort of neoclassical portraits of various people from, you know, various residents.
Mm-hmm.
And we really didn't know much about them. And it turns out the museum, in fact, didn't know that much about those residents there, too, because those portraits had been up for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to recreate that within the exhibition itself. So we did a small version of that gallery within the exhibition. And across from it, we created another gallery that had borrowed works from Kehinde Wiley depicting Carrie Mae Weems. We have mm-hmm. work and photographs from all of the participants who've been involved with the project, so that we have portraits that are looking back at the more classical portraits. So once again, trying to create a situation where there's equal footing and equal context behind all the individuals involved.
New York artist Sanford Biggers taking us inside this multi-year project at the Chazen Museum of Art, bringing new meaning, context into a challenging museum sculpture and the resulting exhibition that is underway. It is called Re-Emancipation. Join in the discussion. Call with a question, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The exhibition, it is called Re-Emancipation. It is a multi-year project dissecting the history of a problematic sculpture at the Chazen Museum of Art in Madison, and through the process, deepening conversations about racial injustice and contentious monuments. Be part of the discussion. Share the number to call in, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sanford Biggers is a visual artist in New York and is behind this exhibit. Let's take a call. Marcus in Milwaukee. Marcus, what would you like to bring up?
So I'm a political science and history double major from UWM. And my feeling on this whole thing is that if we take and start trying to eliminate every single statue or something where it's named after people, we're not going to have anything left of our collective history, even as sordid as it may be, because we'd have to get rid of Washington, D.C., because Washington had slaves. Lincoln had said that he would free the slaves if it would end the war, or he would not free the slaves if it would end the war. It didn't really matter. So I think that the way your artist is and your guest is approaching it, I think it's fantastic, sir. I just want to say that. I think that it's great that we're taking and looking at this and putting it into context, so that that's one step where that statue was in terms of that's how it was portrayed then. But let's put it into context and say, okay, but that still wasn't correct. That's one step down the path. Now we're taking another step down the path, so that we can keep moving forward as a nation and just acknowledge the collective good, bad, and other, because it's what we all share and what we have, and we need to come to terms with it in some kind of meaningful way.
Marcus, thank you. Sanford, go ahead.
I totally agree with you. I think that's exactly why we took this approach. It was a conversation that many of us were having during that time when we started to, you know, see on television all the representations of these monuments being destroyed or vandalized. I've been asked a few times, however, though, if I think that this is the way, if this is the way to handle these things. And just like our caller mentioned, I feel it is a way, just one of many ways. And I can't say that you can rinse and repeat this everywhere, because I think the first people to comment on a work are the people who are most affected by it, meaning the constituents living around each of these works. Mm-hmm. It's really, the onus is on them to deal with it. But this is, like I mentioned before, a proposal. And I anticipate or hope that there are other proposals of ways that we can handle this, but none of them are about erasure and strictly hiding. All of them are about recontextualizing and understanding and finding a way to come to grips with, once again, as the caller said, the good, the bad, and the ugly of our history.
I want to bring up one of the multimedia portions of the exhibit, the theme song from Grandel Thompson and the Marksmen.
You think you gave us something? You think you gave us freedom? Is this emancipation? Is this is how you lead them? Broken down society, this is how you treat them. No more picking cotton, so now you never need them. I got my own Liberty Bells, I'ma start to ring them. Change gon' come, it's a brand new kingdom. They making answers for them, they make us stand and sing them.
Sanford, tell us about theme song. Oh, dear. I think you're breaking up on your phone. Are you?
Hello?
Yes, there we go. There we go. Okay. Yes.
Yes. Theme song is a collaboration, as mentioned, by Grandel Thompson and the Marksmen. And it was, you know, it came out of a relationship between them that they've had for over probably, I guess, almost two decades now, where they worked on several projects together, including things with Chuck D and other MCs. And when the Emancipation Project, when we started getting deeper and deeper into it, we started to bring in other guests, and including Keon Harold and Pharoah Monch and DJ Rich Medina and other artisans, musicians, poets, and so on. And Grandel came up once again because we had this track, and he was the perfect MC and for it. He knew the work, he knew the project, and he had thoughts on this piece as well.
And you know the coolest thing is when you're watching watching him do it, there's the sculpture in the corner. and the Freedman starts, if you can describe it, I mean, just slowly as the song progresses, starts standing straighter
yes.
up.
Until they are not only
eye level, but they are looking straight in the eye of Lincoln. It is so powerful. It was so cool.
Yeah. They did a great job with that. And I think that's indicative of our approach. Once again, very organic. I think there was a freedom of working with a museum like this, and that was hard-earned from all of us, the museum included, of saying, you know, we're really going to push the boundaries of what we can do and how museums usually curate. Mm. And bringing in all these guests and literally animating the sculpture and soundtracking the sculpture was one thing, but then to create a video that showed that as well as all of our invited contributors responding to the piece becomes a very interesting and effective part of the exhibition, because you start on a very didactic journey of the past, and you get into the deep history of the work and the contentious implications of it. And then it leaves you looking forward because you're seeing very contemporary responses to the work. And you, as a viewer, are even given the opportunity to write responses and leave something there so that you can contribute as well.
Let's go to Sandra in Port Washington. Sandra, what would you like to share?
First of all, I'm delighted to hear a rephrasing of what I hope never becomes a cliche. If we do not learn our history, we are doomed to repeat it, because that is such a truth. I am near my eighth decade and gone to law school and done all of those so-called important things. But I must say that I never learned history, because it was always about white, elderly white men with well-developed beards. There were no women. There were no children. There was not much critical thinking going on, and I just didn't get it until I had the privilege of studying art history.
And Sandra, and I have to cut you short. I'm so sorry. And Sanford, we only have a few more moments here, but Sandra really opened her world, it sounds like, through art and art history.
Well, that's it. Exactly, Sandra. And I appreciate you saying that. Same for me. And once again, this is one of the fields where we can discuss and investigate history and imbalance and all these things in a way that is nuanced and critical, but at the same time, potentially appealing and attractive. So it has, you know, the best of both worlds. It draws you in, but it makes you think and contemplate. And to the adage that you suggested, I often think of history is written by the victors, but I say the future is open source.
So we must take
the history and move it forward.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Mm-hmm. My pleasure.
Sanford Biggers, contemporary visual artist in New York, Remancipation exhibit running through June 25th. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about losing a loved one during wartime just ahead of Memorial Day.
For those who have fought and died in the U.S. Armed Forces, they leave with their families the weight of their sacrifice. Holly Higgins of Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, lost her son Daniel Johnson while he served in the Air Force in Afghanistan. Higgins talks about dealing with her loss with her other son, Eric Johnson, a specialist in the U.S. Army National Guard. They shared their experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
My name is Eric Johnson. I am 30 years old. I am in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin. I am here with my mother, Holly Higgins.
Holly Higgins. I'm 64 years old here in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, with my son, Eric. What triggered you to want to go into the service to begin with?
One of my older brothers out of four, Dan, was in the Air Force, and he had been for 2, maybe 3 years. He joined when I was still in high school, and I remember seeing a change in him in the way that he treated me as an older brother. I could tell that the military definitely impacted the way that he treated others, and I kind of wanted that for myself. In the transition of me making the decision to actually join, we found out that Dan was killed overseas. It wasn't an easy decision, but I think through his sacrifice, he still convinced me that what he stood for in regards to freedom and wanting to help others in the world, that it was worth it.
You know, it took me back. Hearing you talking about it makes me think back to when he first told me he was going to go into the Air Force and how I cried for many weeks. I was more afraid of him being hurt emotionally by war and combat. I didn't let myself even think that he could be physically or that he would die. And I remember him saying to me, you know, Mom, I'm going over there to save lives, not to take them. I don't even know how to put it, but I think knowing how important everything had become to you with what you were doing as an adult in your life, I was impressed with your courage, with your ability to choose to do what was right for you. And it was impressive. I'll always be afraid for you and your other brothers. You know, I mean, before Dan's death, I didn't think anything would ever happen to you guys. I just didn't think it could be possible. It wasn't going to happen to us, you know. Now I know that it can. And so there'll always be that. But I don't let that affect what I say to you or my trust and belief and hopes and pride in the choices that you make. I think you probably know about the mug he gave me and what that's come to represent for me with the poppies on it.
Yeah.
It's brought my spirit the ability to accept that this was Dan's destiny. That he found that mug in Scotland when he was 16 and brought it home for me. And at that point, no military discussion had ever been brought up. At the time, I didn't even notice that they were poppies. And he didn't know any, I don't think he knew what that would even mean. And it wasn't until 7 years after he was killed that I realized those were poppies on that month. And knowing that poppies represent the death on the battlefield has brought me just a peace in my soul. I mean, I'll never not be brokenhearted and wounded over Dan's death. I'll never not miss him, and I'll never feel like it was okay that it happened. But I know in my spirit that somehow it was his destiny. It was his path.
That was Holly Higgins and Eric Johnson of Sun Prairie, Wisconsin. They shared their experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. All five Wisconsin investor-owned utilities have rate cases pending before the State Public Service Commission for proposed increases to electricity rates. That's according to the utilities watchdog group Citizens Utility Board of Wisconsin. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Tom Content is here, Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Wisconsin. Tom, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, great to be back. Thanks, Kate.
Well, let's list off the four investor-owned utilities we're speaking about here. Rate hikes, seeking rate hikes are Alliant Energy, Xcel Energy, Madison Gas and Electric, and We Energies. Why are these utilities saying customers should pay higher rates?
Well, we're seeing a lot of increases at the same time. In fact, it's about $500 million in total extra added costs that would be hitting customers in 2024 and 2025 under these proposals. So it's a lot of it is driven by the building construction of new power plants, whether that's solar, some battery storage, some natural gas as well. We are in a building cycle, so that does put pressure on rates. But it is a lot to see the size of some of these increases, especially on the heels of the higher costs that people were already facing last winter and with increases that just took effect in January.
So the utilities are saying, look, we have these renewable energy projects that need to get off the ground, and that requires some upfront additional funding from customers. Is that the line?
It is, because with solar projects, almost the entire cost of the project is attached to the construction cost and just building it and getting it online. Because once you build it, there is no fuel cost for when the sun is shining. There's a big fuel cost with natural gas and coal, and there's no fuel cost with solar. So we're seeing that there's cost pressure now, and the hope is that the utility customers will see savings from the additional renewable energy that they're adding. And in fact, the one utility that has a decrease is adding, they're actually, WPS of Green Bay, Wisconsin Public Service, is actually seeking extra funding for solar, but it's more than offset by lower costs for fuel, for paying for natural gas and coal. So that's kind of interesting.
In that respect, if higher rates are needed for these upfront costs, could rates eventually come down?
That's our hope, because we've had the second highest electricity rates in the Midwest for too long here in Wisconsin, and so we do think that solar is cost effective, but we've been hit with this storm of higher natural gas costs last year, higher coal costs, putting pressure on customers. And so everything's kind of hitting at the same time, which is challenging.
I wonder, along those lines, what are the other market pressures? I mean, is some of the rate hike proposals due to inflationary pressures, that everything is costing more?
Exactly. So the cost of equipment, the utilities are citing inflation as well as some of the factors. But also embedded in these increases is requests for higher profit for two of the three utilities that have full rate cases. So it's in particular, Alliant and Xcel are seeking to actually have more money flow to their profit and to their shareholders through their proposals. And that's just our profits in Wisconsin for utilities, for monopoly utilities, have been too high and well above the national average for a very long time. And we, at CUB, the Citizens Utility Board, we definitely see opportunities for savings there.
How is the PSC, the Public Service Commission, interacting with profit margins of these public utilities? Like whether they're allowing larger profit margins or cutting the utilities' profit margins, what do you see?
So there had been, our profits have been above the national average, as I said. There has been some moves to bring that down somewhat in the last year's decisions involving We Energies and Wisconsin Public Service. The profit rates were brought down a bit, and that ended up saving those customers about $40 million this year, and also another $40 million next year, which is good. We just think that the commission should have gone further because we cite to national research that shows that customers across the country are overpaying by billions of dollars every year just for profits. Utilities have cheaper ways to raise capital to fund their businesses than just putting it all on the backs of the customers and adding to their profits.
Looking to Governor Evers' two-year state budget plan, it calls for $170,000 to fund software that is aimed at improving how the Public Service Commission evaluates utility rate changes. What can be improved in how the agency evaluates these rate applications?
Yeah, that's actually an interesting request. We support that because the utilities are using state-of-the-art modeling software to help them determine which projects make sense for the customers. But as the consumer advocate, we don't have access to that software. It's very expensive, and even the PSC, the regulator that oversees the utilities, doesn't have access to that. So it's actually a really smart proposal to help the auditors and analysts over at the commission analyze the cost effectiveness and the need for all the new generation projects, all the new power plant projects that are putting pressure on our rates.
Tom Content is here, leads the watchdog organization, Citizens Utility Board of Wisconsin. Join in at any point in the discussion. Call in with a question at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin utilities seek rate increases ahead on top of what the Public Service Commission already approved that went into effect this year. We break down what these pending cases mean for ratepayers. Call in with a question, your comments on utility bills, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tom Content is Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Wisconsin. Tom, we heard from Steve and Madison Calden to say, look, I think it's healthy to do what we're doing with all the solar expansion. Even if it costs a little bit more now, it will reduce pollution. What do you make of that thinking?
Oh, I think there's a lot of folks, a lot of people across the state who believe in that clean energy transition. And I think certainly when the proposals come forward, depending on the proposal, our analysts are looking at whether we think that the plan is cost effective. We think it's no doubt that the solar is cost effective, and obviously moving away from fossil fuels carries a lot of environmental benefits. So I think there is a good segment of the population that agrees with that. But we just want to make sure that everything is the most cost effective that can be. And right now, the way our system is set up, we think that there's so many incentives just focused on building rather than helping utility customers save energy. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the focuses we'd like to see, where we think that when the utilities actually set those, when the commission actually sets those profit rates, they should take other things into account other than just the fact that they're building more solar. It should be a variety of things, like looking at affordability, customer service, reliability.
So looking at a lot more things and then just focusing on one thing. You mentioned earlier the spike in natural gas prices, and Alliant Energy provides gas and electricity to parts of central southern Wisconsin as well. Next year, the utility is seeking to hike natural gas rates by 6.3%, electricity rates by 8.4%. How typical are rate hikes of this size?
So I think what's been typical in the last 5 years, we had a period of lower rate hikes, in part because we weren't in this build as much in a building phase for new power plants, and in part because of benefits from corporate tax reform law that came through Congress that ended up enabling savings for customers. But what we're seeing now is really sizable. If an Alliant in particular, they are over 2 years on the electric side, they're seeking 14%, which is very sizable. We don't double digits are not the norm in terms of the types of increases that generally come through. Having said that, of course, our hope is that this is just, this is the opening bid, if you will, and that the staff auditors over at the Public Service Commission, while people are enjoying the summer, outdoors this summer, the auditors will be working hard on their audits of these proposals, and CUB will be working hard on its proposals to try to bring down the size of these increases.
Let's bring on another call. Mike in Wauwatosa. Mike, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Good morning. I am in complete support of a conversion into renewable energies. My concern is that if we take the rate hike, what assurances does the average person have that once they've recouped the investment on the building of all these new facilities, that rates will come down once costs come down and back to normal level? Or is it just going to end up meaning a higher profit in the long run for the energy company?
Mike, thank you for bringing that up. Tom, what would you say there?
I think Mike Riggs is a really good point. And it's I think it's good to be skeptical about whether rates will actually come down and bills will actually come down, because of the cost pressures that we've seen over time, and the fact that that we've been giving our utilities a more generous profits than they deserve. I think the fact is that this transition should make sense, but it's a question of how do you execute this transition. And one of the things that Wisconsin lacks that other states have in place is better planning for how the energy transition unfolds. The PSC in Wisconsin does not have the tools that are in place in Minnesota and many other states to actually look at the long-term plan and to look at the big picture and evaluate what's really needed. And that's one of the planks that we would like in terms of reform, in terms of enabling a more cost-effective energy transition.
So like the Wisconsin Clean Energy Plan doesn't give enough of a blueprint for these utilities and for Wisconsin in terms of, having a shared vision?
It's related to the Clean Energy Plan, but it's okay. Actually, each utility has its own plan that they talk to Wall Street about what they plan to build. And in Wisconsin, there's no actually mechanism to actually evaluate that long-term plan. In Wisconsin, we're kind of, everything is kind of siloed. So every time a power plant is proposed, that's what the commission is reviewing. I mean, unfortunately, the commission lacks a big picture on things. And when you lack a big picture, you can't see all the moving parts, right? Mm-hmm. As well as you should. And that can result in overbuilding and overspending, which adds layers on costs for you and me.
Tom Content is here, head of the Citizens Utility Board of Wisconsin. As we look at the proposals for rate hikes and control of Wisconsin utilities, you can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Bring up your question. Tom, progressive groups in Milwaukee are urging the city to create a municipal utility. Milwaukee and other southeastern Wisconsin residents currently receive electricity services from We Energies. How difficult, how big of a step would it be to establish a municipal utility to replace a provider?
It has happened over time that investor-owned utility areas have gone to municipalization, but it is really a long shot. The proposal actually just underscores the concern that there is about affordability and responsiveness on the part of the utility. But I think in Wisconsin's experience over the last 20 years, the only times when it's ever happened that there has been a conversion from an investor-owned company to municipal has been when the company itself has actually proposed it. There were some utilities that owned small water utilities that as part of their portfolio of businesses, when at the point when the utilities were diversifying into all kinds of things, and the utilities decided to sell those back to the local communities, whether in eastern Wisconsin or in southern Wisconsin. But this is a real long shot proposal to try to do this, but I think it does highlight kind of the affordability challenge that We Energy's customers have been facing.
I think we're also dancing around here the issue of deregulation. I mean, we have the PSC, the Public Service Commission. Wisconsin hasn't deregulated our energy markets here. What impact is that having on our utility costs? Whereas other places, other states, it's a different picture.
Other states did deregulate, and we, even though we're concerned about our high costs, we think a strong Public Service Commission oversight of our monopoly utilities is the way to go, rather than deregulation. The experience we've seen in other states with deregulation, whether it's Illinois or Maryland, you see a lot of companies coming in, whether it's fly by night or not, but a lot of people coming in with here's a deal you can't refuse kind of thing, promise of low rates, but the fine print is much different. And that was one of the big problems that hit customers hard after the blackouts. There was some of the price impacts from what they thought were good deals that turned out to be not very good deals at all.
A few seconds left here. Timeline. These cases before the Public Service Commission. Any idea on outcome, when the outcomes will come?
It should be by the end of the year. And before that, there will be the customers themselves will be allowed to weigh in through public comments. There's a link on our website, cubwi.org, to the public comment page of the Public Service Commission. The window for public comments hasn't opened yet, but it will open in the summertime. And there will be public hearings, in-person public hearings, we expect for all these cases around the state and in Madison, probably in the September-October timeframe. So looking forward
to
seeing a lot of people participating.
Tom, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
Tom Content, Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Wisconsin. For disclosure, Citizens Utility Board is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.